For more than three decades, T. Edward Nickens has reported on conservation, the outdoors, and Southern culture for some of the world's most respected publications. He is editor-at-large for Field & Stream, contributing editor to both Garden and Gun and Audubon magazines, and a monthly columnist for Our State magazine, where his Ramblin' Man column is now in its fifth year. A New York Times best-selling author, Nickens' book, The Last Wild Road, Adventures and Essays from a Sporting Life, was recently published. He is NCWF's communication editor since the late 1980s and chair of the Governor's Conservation Achievement Awards Program for the past 20 years. Eddie, it's all yours.
Hey there, thanks so much. Welcome to the North Carolina Wildlife Federation Charlie Shaw Society Conference Call. We're glad you could join us today for a discussion about conservation policy, certainly something that is on top of everyone's mind. Hey, before we start, let me introduce our panelists for the Charlie Shaw Call today. Kari Barsness has more than 20 years of experience in public policy and government relations in North Carolina. Throughout her career, she's represented state agencies working in the executive branch and as legislative director for North Carolina's Department of Natural Resources. She's worked for trade organizations and not-for-profits before the General Assembly. In each of her positions, Kari has brought leadership and energy to her work in the field, and Kari has broad bipartisan relationships across North Carolina state government and the General Assembly. In addition to the legislative process, she understands how the regulatory process works, and she navigates this for her clients. Kari also has an in-depth knowledge of the state budget. Also on the call is Tom Bean. And Tom works as an advocate for protection of natural resources and public health. He's been at that for more than 30 years. He earned both his BS and his MS in political science at Virginia Tech, and he started out as an NCWF canvasser in 1988. He worked his way all the way up to run the canvas operation and served as both interim and permanent executive director of the organization before leaving in 1998. Tom was founding executive director for the Tar River Land Conservancy, and he began his career as a full-time lobbyist at the North Carolina General Assembly and with state agencies in 2002. He represents the North Carolina Wildlife Federation and other environmental and clean energy nonprofits. But Tom has worked for the passage of many important pieces of legislation and regulation, beginning with his work on behalf of the North Carolina Wildlife Federation on the Fisheries Reform Act, the Water Supply Watershed Protection Act, the establishment of the Clean Water Management Trust Fund, which is now the Land and Water Fund, and legislation to regulate municipal and agricultural discharges of nutrients into the Neuse and Tar River, and he's definitely been at work on renewable energy standards. We've also got Manly Fuller with us. Now, Manly is one of the nation's most effective conservation leaders. He led the Florida Wildlife Federation as its president and CEO for more than three decades. And while there, he championed many conservation causes, including changing Florida's constitution to prohibit coastal oil and gas drilling, providing for a major 20-year conservation land acquisitions fund, tax relief for landowners placing property under conservation easements. He's worked on unification of Florida's fish and wildlife agencies into the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and stewarding limitations on entangling nets in state waters. Now, prior to taking the helm at the Florida Wildlife Federation, Manly served 5 years with the National Wildlife Federation as a wetlands and wildlife specialist in its Southeastern Natural Resources Center based here in Raleigh. At the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, Manly is working with the North Carolina legislature on issues including marine fisheries reform, climate change, storm resiliency, and natural resource investments, as well as advancing many of North Carolina Wildlife Federation's programs to safeguard wildlife and habitat. And last, we have Tim Gestwicki, who has led the North Carolina Wildlife Federation for more than two decades. Now, Tim started as a canvasser for the group in 1991 and became CEO in 2009, and he's grown the North Carolina Wildlife Federation from a budget deficit organization to a multi-million dollar organization. And under his leadership, more than 18 North Carolina Wildlife Federation chapters have formed. Great Outdoors University has served more than 27,000 youth per year. More than 30,000 acres of polythene habitat have been restored, and more than 60,000 meals of ground venison per year have been provided to help feed the hungry in partnership with processors and community food banks. Tim's often seen testifying in front of elected officials or happily sitting in a duck blind. Tim, take it away.
Eddie, thanks so much, brother, and I'm so proud for you of your newest book, The Last Wild Road, and look forward to getting it autographed in person when we go fishing later this summer together. Thanks for being part of this call, and I really do appreciate all our donors listening in as we talk about policy today. We're grateful. We can't do this work without you, and so we wanted to provide this special kind of glimpse inside our policy work. Summer's here now, and things are heating up in the legislature, and for sure, you know, we're seeing summer bloom in our backyards, too. We had a party last night at my house for a birthday and grilling out, and the kids were all running around catching fireflies, lightning bugs, and it won't be long before we hear that southern sound of the cicadas coming into the backyards, too, so I appreciate everybody joining us and taking time to have a conversation with us.
Absolutely. Thanks again for everybody. We're going to jump right into conservation policy. We've got a lot to talk about. And we realize that just that very word policy is fraught. It brings up a lot of feelings for folks, especially these days when so much around policy seems to be contested. But what's not contested is that in the past, Congress has passed huge wins for wildlife and habitat conservation. The Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, they were passed by Congress. They were signed into law in the early 1970s by President Richard Nixon. And the Endangered Species Act is why we have bald eagles in the skies today. It's why we have grizzly bears that have been able to make a huge comeback since their listing. And those are just two of the 46 species now listed that are considered recovered under the ESA. Now, if you could believe it, you know, before the Clean Waters Act, the news reports were full of rivers that literally used to catch fire. So all of this is to say that policy itself can make or break progress for conservation. Now, Tim, a lot of listeners on the call support the North Carolina Wildlife Federation because of its policy and its advocacy work for wildlife and for wildlife habitat conservation. So Could you share with folks the importance of the North Carolina Wildlife Federation's conservation policy work, especially for those who may not know quite enough about it?
Yeah, absolutely, Eddie. And for 75 years, policy work has been a hallmark of our organization. You know, we speak for the wildlife and the wild places that don't have a voice. And, you know, quite frankly, conservation is that common denominator. And whether Republican, Democrat, Independent, it doesn't matter. Conservation is a common bond. And, you know, I generally often say, you know, I've never met a Republican black bear or a Democratic striped bass or gone to a Republican national park or a Democratic wildlife refuge. It's commonality and policy. And when we back it with science and figure out the best for wildlife and habitat and people, you know, people, the same holy trinity of air, water, land for wildlife is also good for people. And our Charlie Shaw Society board chair, John Robbins, who people are getting letters from with their book choices this week, often says what's good for wildlife is without question good for people. And our policy work is where it gets done. You know, if you're not at the table, they say you're on the menu. So we've got to be there day in, day out. I know some of our folks are at the legislature today, and whether we're lobbying in the legislature or working on forest management plans, working and testifying at marine fisheries commissions, dealing with the executive branch, it's all about policy that drives the outcome. So I'm glad that our folks can hear specifically today about legislature, both the General Assembly primarily and then also with their delegation. So it's all policy all the time.
All policy all the time sort of underscores the importance of this work to the Wildlife Federation. And I know that Tom Bean Tom has been at this for so many years with the Wildlife Federation. Tom, for listeners who aren't as versed in the day-to-day lobbying game as you are, give us a feel for what is entailed when we talk about the General Assembly and the legislative process. On how does the Wildlife Federation work inside that process?
Thank you, Eddie. I'd be happy to do that. The way that it works in North Carolina is, of course, discussions about conservation and wildlife go on continuously. But as far as the legislative policy debate, the way that it's structured is it goes back to the assumption that North Carolina has a citizen legislature. And the idea of that is that folks will get elected to office as a civic duty, and they will continue to have a life outside of the General Assembly. And in order to facilitate that, the way that the North Carolina General Assembly organizes its work is after we have elections in the even-numbered year, the following January, we start what's called the long session. And the reason it's called the long session is because in the long session, what they do is they adopt a two-year budget, a biennial budget. And the idea is that you're going to do that and consider that, adopt it during the long session. And then in the following year, the back to the even-numbered year again, when there's going to be an election in the fall, you have a short session, which the long session generally runs from January to late summer, maybe. And the short session doesn't start until May and then runs typically into July. And the idea, at least originally, was that all that you would do really in the short session is reconcile the difference between revenues expected when the budget was adopted and the revenues actually received, and any changes in appropriations that have to be made because you have a more appropriate, you have more revenues than you expected or less revenues than you expected. So that's the basic structure. You know, you get started, you start the discussion, not just on the budget, but on policy issues in the long session, and then finish that up in the short session. And in order to try and move that along, the General Assembly has adopted a rule, an important rule, that during the long session, a bill that does not have either an appropriation or a finance provision has to pass one chamber or the other by the crossover date, which is in May. And if it passes, it's over in the other chamber, then it's eligible for consideration for the rest of the long session and the short session the following year. If not, then it's no longer eligible, and so that bill is dead. Now, having said that, bills may be dead, but ideas can come back to life. And the other thing is that in appropriations or finance bills, you'll see policy issues that are get taken up in the course of that. Those are more guidelines than rules, but that's the way that it works in general. I guess it's worth mentioning, just as you think about advocating for policy in the General Assembly, that in both the House and Senate of the North Carolina General Assembly, the Republicans are in the majority, as they have been since 2010. The governor, of course, Roy Cooper, is a Democrat. And in North Carolina, we do have a gubernatorial veto, and there is enough Democrats in both chambers that if the governor were to veto and it was a straight party line vote, the governor's veto would be sustained. So that, as there's some balance between the General Assembly and the executive branch, and a lot of going back and forth. I'll talk more about it when we talk about budget, but that can result in a stalemate over big marquee issues.
Yeah, and when you bring up that word stalemate, Tom, we've all heard about budget stalemates. So money is what drives this process, what greases the wheels. It's what pays for these programs. We know that we've heard of what a budget stalemate is. What exactly is it? What does that mean? And what's the impact on budgets and stalemates on getting things passed? And where do things stand today in the legislature?
The way that North Carolina General Assembly tries to make things orderly on the budget process is every other 2 years, the two chambers alternate which chamber starts the budget process. So in this biennium, the Senate, it's its turn to start the budget process. So the Senate will deliberate over its desired budget. It'll pass its budget, and then it will go over to the House, and the House always has different priorities, and so they vote to not concur with the Senate budget resolution, and then they do their own budget, and they send that revised bill, which is still the same bill, back over to the Senate. The Senate then always votes to not to concur, and they go to conference committee, which I think most folks have heard of. That's where the two chambers and any bicameral system sit down to work out differences over a specific bill or law. And then, so there can be a stalemate in that, and those stalemates have dragged on for weeks and weeks in the late summer and years past, even between majorities of the same party. But there's, once they manage to get through that stalemate and agree on a conference report, that gets adopted by both chambers, and then it's sent to the governor, and the governor has to sign it in order for it to, the governor can't veto the budget or any other bill except for some few dealing with like electoral issues. And then once the governor has vetoed it, then the legislature can try to override that veto, but as long as the party line votes hold, then you are in our current situation, you're at a stalemate, and then the legislature and has to be in earnest about negotiating with the governor about trying to get some kind of agreement that they will pass and the governor will sign or at least not veto. There, in recent years, in fact, in the last biennium, they did not succeed in coming to agreement with the governor. And that's a different kind of stalemate. But having seen the bad outcomes that we've seen at the federal level, where if you don't adopt a budget, then the government shuts down, North Carolina's General Assembly passed a law a few years ago that said that if there is no budget adopted, no formal budget adopted, then the agencies and programs would continue on with their funding from the last budget, but this is an important but, only at the level that it was funded for recurring. So the level of funding that the General Assembly said, this program gets this level of funding every year. In addition to recurring appropriations, in every budget, there are also, with whatever additional revenue they have, they make non-recurring appropriations, which are important to programs being fully funded. But because there are basically funds that can't be relied upon to always come in each year, they're appropriated on a non-recurring basis, which means they are only appropriated for the years that they're targeted to in the two-year biennium. So what that means is that right now the Senate's working on its budget. Supposedly it will roll its budget out next week. There was a long period where the House and Senate couldn't even agree on what their total spend would be for this biennium. That was complicated somewhat by the fact that due to putting off the due date for taxes in 2020 during the beginning of the COVID pandemic, we wound up with the last quarter of 2020 taxes being paid in the 2021 budget. So there's a $5 billion windfall. So there's non-recurring money, a lot of it, but now the General Assembly is wrestling with how to spend that non-recurring money. The Senate is generally inclined to spend less of it, put money in the rainy day fund. They've got a tax cut bill that they have taken up. But the two chambers have now agreed on about $26 billion, and that's what has freed up the Senate to go ahead and get its budget passed in the upcoming week, and to get really get the process started in earnest. So the budget matters for reasons that are pretty obvious, but basically it's because all of the programs really that the Wildlife Federation cares about, Wildlife Resources Commission funding, the funding for the conservation trust funds, funding for resiliency, all of those are going to have to be worked out in the budget. And so we, you know, will lobby and advocate for this, our specific asks, and hope that we can get those into both the Senate and House budgets, and that the governor, and that a budget will pass. So those appropriations actually come to the programs. So I'll stop there.
So Tom, inside the budget as it exists right now, what are the Wildlife Federation priorities? Where are the places that we're really wanting to put some action and some advocacy behind?
The main priorities that the North Carolina Wildlife Federation is focused on are funding for the conservation trust funds, and that conservation trust funds is shorthand for a handful of trust funds that have specific missions. So that includes the North Carolina Land and Water Fund, that used to be known, and some still know it by its old name, the Clean Water Management Trust Fund. But the Wildlife Federation, along with a whole host of land and water conservation groups, are advocating for an increase in its recurring appropriation to $20 million. That's up from about $17 million base budget a year. And asking for a non-recurring appropriation of $75 million to utilize a piece of that $5 billion additional revenues that we have this year but won't have again next year. The other major conservation trust fund is the North Carolina Parks and Recreation Trust Fund. So for that, the same ask, $20 million in recurring appropriations, which is a bump up from about $17 million a year that's been in the budget in recent years. And that additional $75 million in non-recurring appropriations, an additional $75 million in non-recurring appropriations from out of that windfall as a result of COVID. So the Land and Water Fund is basically focused more, as you would think from the title, on the broad mission of conservation of land and water resources. The North Carolina Parks and Recreation Trust Fund is more focused on specifically on North Carolina and local parks and the recreation aspect of it. Now, having said that, there tends to be a lot of coordination and overlap between the projects that get funded by those two different fund. So they represent a kind of a 1-2 punch for conservation in the North Carolina budget. On policy, let me mention three things. One is it's a goal to restore the conservation income tax credit. North Carolina for years had a conservation tax credit that would allow, if, say, I donated a conservation easement, if I imposed a conservation easement on the farm that my wife and I live on and said, this land can never be developed, it can only be used for farming and grazing timber and growing wildlife, then the difference in the value, the lost value that in between its full development value, if it was turned into trailer parks or commercial real estate, that would be that value that I forego would be the value that I could take in the tax credit. So it existed for years. Years ago, the Republican majorities went to war against tax credits of all sorts, and the conservation tax credit, as worthy as it is, fell victim to that initiative on their part to get rid of all tax credits. So it has been in a bill that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, in one version of a bill. House Bill 500, which deals with resiliency. It's come out of that bill now, but at least it's good to know that the appropriators and leaders of the chambers are talking about the conservation tax credit again and potentially restoring it. Second policy bullet I'll mention is authorize new state park units. But breaking good news on this, the authorization to include the East Coast Greenway as a part of the state trails system is House Bill 130. That has passed both the House and the Senate and now goes to the governor, who's expected to sign it. The bill, House Bill 360, that would authorize inclusion of the Dan River in the state trails program has passed the House and today passed Senate Ag and Environment unanimously. So it looks in good shape to also pass the Senate and go to the governor. And so the importance of inclusion as of those two programs, those two sites as part of the state trails system is it makes them eligible for funding from a variety of different sources to do maintenance and operation of those amenities. The final policy issue that I'll mention is one that's a little wonky, and I'll give you the simplest version of it. It's the Uniform Partition of Heirs Property Act, and it deals with a situation which arises when through multiple generations after a family, for the most part, stops all living on a farm, there's sort of two ways you can go in that situation. Some families subdivide, and each generation gets a smaller and smaller piece of the original home place. Some families choose or default to making all the heirs joint owners of a piece of property. And in that second situation, an abuse that has arisen is that sometimes land speculators will buy out a single party, a single member of the family, and own their interest, which then gives them the legal right to force a auction of the land in order that they can extract their value from that jointly owned property. But the way that this has been abused is that they'll buy out a one person's interest in the joint ownership and force the auction and then be lined up at the county courthouse to offer a very undervalued price for the entire property. And so it's a way that families lose their family farm, So what this bill would do is it would provide for an orderly process. It would allow all the members of the family to be able to have their interests represented in that process, so they get the true value of their of the family farm if it does wind up being sold. That's important because passing a law like this, and it's a model bill that's been passed in numerous states, makes the farm eligible for makes farms held in jointly like that eligible for federal farm programs and other things that make, again, benefit the family and keeping the family farm together. So that's a quick rundown of the both the appropriations and the policy asks that the Wildlife Federation is focused on, at least some of them.
Hey, thanks much, Tom. It's always fascinating to realize how the very idea of conservation and conservation policy touches on so many different aspects of life, from inheritance to just it's so deeply ingrained. I want to move over to Kari. I want to talk a bit about marine fisheries. It's summertime. I know that I enjoy eating plenty of good local seafood, and definitely concerned about there being local seafood in the future. I know Kari, the team's working hard on this matter of marine fisheries. Can you give us sort of the lay of the land there, a little bit of history, a little bit of background on the Wildlife Federation's work as regards marine fisheries?
Can you all hear me now? I was talking on a muted phone.
Happens to the best of us, Kari. Go right ahead.
I know. We've had a year of technology, and I'm still learning how to make it work. But yes, of course, Peggy, I'd be glad to. So for decades, and probably more years than my age, but I'm not telling you how old I am, marine fisheries have been in, these issues have been incredibly controversial. I want to touch a bit on the history of these issues, just to give you guys some context. A major piece of legislation back in 1997 was passed. It was the Fisheries Reform Act, and I think there really was high hopes that the management tools that were created in this legislation, management tools to manage our marine resources, would provide a science-based approach to managing these species. Unfortunately, the opposite has happened, and I'm sure you guys are all aware that fish stocks since 1997, give or take, have been depleted. And in particular, there are some species where the fish stocks have dropped upwards of 90%. Part of the reason for this is that there's no accountability and no repercussions for failure to achieve the goals that were set out in the Fisheries Reform Act, which was to ensure a sustainable harvest, which means these fish would be around for generations to come. And so here we are, 25 years later, and we're in a pretty dire situation. Of course, there's been attempts to make meaningful change over the years, but those changes have frankly fallen flat. Bottom line, the fish wars in the legislature have been preventing any meaningful legislation to actually move any good policy forward. And I'm sure you're wondering why this is. Quite frankly, the fights have always come down to the recreational fishermen against the commercial fishermen. And quite frankly, coastal legislators don't want to do anything that's really going to upset their constituents. A lot of the coastal legislators have commercial fishermen in their district. Some do have some recreational fishermen as well. But what's really happened is that over the years, these issues have really just focused on coastal issues. And as a result of that, all of the inland legislators, which of course, by the way, is the majority of the legislature, have frankly ignored, stayed away from it because they see how contentious this is. That framing is actually really important. And it's important because over the last couple of years, now moving forward to 2019, I believe it was, Marine Fisheries made a concerted effort and was very successful in changing that conversation. We wanted to get away from the wreck versus the commercial fishermen because that just became a big fight. And legislators typically don't like that much controversy at the General Assembly. As you all know, North Carolina Wildlife Federation mission is to preserve and protect marine and land species and their habitats. And that is exactly how our messaging has been at the state legislature. We care about the resource and we focus on the resource. And quite honestly, the legislation that we've been supportive in the last couple of years, and I'll touch on these, would have impact on both the commercial fishing industry and the recreational fishing industry. And we recognize that and we know that. And honestly, that's what needs to happen to in order to start preserving our marine resources. So I'll start with a bill introduced in 2019 called Let Them Spawn. The bill was actually quite simple. It would set size limits for six marine fish. These size limits would impact both what commercial and recreational fishermen could catch and harvest and keep. In essence, it would ensure that these six fish species, would be able to spawn at least once before they were allowed to be harvested. And obviously the implication there is if they can spawn at least once, there's more fish available to continue to grow and then continue to spawn and to increase our fish stocks over time. How we manage this at the legislature, again, is we focused on the resource. We focused on the depleted stocks. We also lobbied a lot of the inland legislators very hard. They have a lot of recreational fishermen in their districts. And as you guys all know this, there are many more recreational fishermen than there are commercial fishermen in the states. And by engaging those inland legislators, in particular some that are recreational fishermen themselves, really brought some support from very powerful legislators. Both Republicans and Democrats, just so you all know, you've heard Tim say this, marine fisheries issues are not Republican or not Democratic issues. That's just not how these issues play at the General Assembly. We did actually have some real good success with that legislation. It was the first meaningful legislation to pass either chamber in about 20 years. I will tell you, it was a lot of hard work. It was a full court press. I won't go into all the details and all the hurdles we had to achieve to have that success and pass the House. But it was a full team effort. Everyone on this call that you'll be hearing from, we all really worked our tails off to achieve that. So remember, that was in 2019. And then, of course, we all know what happened in March of 2020 and things changed and the focus shifted completely to the pandemic, which we understand. So talking about legislation in the current year, I'm going to focus on two bills. There have been a couple other bills, but these two are of most interest to the Wildlife Federation. The first I'll talk about is a Senate bill. This bill is not something we support. The title is called Marine Fisheries Reform, but do not be confused. This bill is not a good bill from our perspective. In essence, the bill attempts to make changes to the management and the structure of the Marine Fisheries Commission and the Division of Marine Fisheries. However, frankly, it only rearranges deck chairs. We like to use that nomenclature because people understand that analogy. What it does do is it gives more authority to DEQ, but it does not fix the real problems that we have with marine fisheries management in North Carolina. And these two points are really important. Number one, there is a lack of science-based management being used to manage our marine fisheries in the state of North Carolina. Secondly, as I mentioned earlier, the marine fisheries, the Fisheries Reform Act has been, quite frankly, a complete failure. And that's because the Fisheries Reform Act really has zero accountability within that legislation to ensure the sustainability of our marine fisheries. So those two points are really important. And I want you guys to keep thinking about that in your head. So moving on to the House bill that we actually had introduced, the bill is a bill to save the southern flounder. And this bill was actually introduced as a direct result of the Marine Fisheries Commission inability to pass meaningful changes to the current management plan that's in place on southern flounder. Because the southern flounder stock is so depleted, and in fact, the science says that there needs to be an annual 72% reduction, and yes, I did say annual 72% reduction, the Marine Fisheries Commission has not demonstrated an ability to manage the resource effectively, and so that's why we've asked Representative Yarbrough to introduce this bill. Just in summary, the bill does four things. It creates a slot limit for the southern flounder. The slot limit based on science is best to allow older, larger female flounder to spawn. That's when they're more prolific, and that allows more juvenile fish to be, more fish to be quote unquote born so that they can continue to flourish and spawn as they get older. The second thing it does is it creates a payback for the total allowable catch. In essence, there's a quota in place right now with the southern flounder. And remember, they need to achieve a 72% reduction. And so if that reduction is not met, next year's catch must be reduced by the amount that they overfished in the prior year. Again, that's accountability that is not in the Fisheries Reform Act currently. Number three, this is also a pretty significant change. During shrimp trawling and other types of fishing, there's what's called bycatch or discards that just end up typically dying because that's not the fish they're wanting to catch, so they just throw them off the boat. This still would require the accounting of bycatch as part of the quota when commercial and recreational fishermen are out catching fish for that particular season. As I said, they're currently ignored in the total allowable catch calculation. The last thing that the bill does is it sets up a moratorium in 2028 if the stocks do not improve. What I will say about the southern flounder bill is now, granted, it's just for southern flounder, but again, we introduced it because of the Marine Fisheries Commission failure to effectively manage. What this bill does is addresses those two fundamental issues I just mentioned. Number one, using science-based management. Again, that's where the slot limit comes into place. And number two, adding accountability into the management of the southern flounder, and that's why the payback and accounting for bycatch and the moratorium are all really critical pieces to ensure accountability of how we manage the southern flounder. So I'm going to wrap up. I just wanted to give you a highlight, both overview history and some of the current legislation that we're working on. But just to wrap up, I really want to, again, hone in on a few points. And I think these points are important for you guys to remember, even write down, and even maybe communicate to policymakers. Number one, our fish stocks are reaching crisis levels. We have data to show this, but we really are getting to a point where it's really becoming a crisis. Number two, as a North Carolina Wildlife Federation supporter, our conversations, all of our conversations, in particular, particularly at the legislature and with policymakers, our conversations really need to focus on the resource. It's not effective to pit the commercial and the recreational fishermen against each other. We talk about the resource and how our resource is depleted. And then number three, again, the Fisheries Reform Act, as I've mentioned a few times now, has been a complete failure for two reasons. Number one, the policymakers are not making science-based management decisions to manage our marine resources. And the second is there's no accountability or repercussions in the Fisheries Reform Act to see improvements in our fish stocks. And quite frankly, any policy decisions moving forward really must address these two issues in order to start seeing some successes with our marine resources. Thanks, Eddie. That's all I have, and I'll go ahead and turn it back over to you.
Well, that's a lot on your plate, Kari, and we appreciate you working so hard on these issues. I wanted to bring Manly in here as we start to wrap this up. Manly, we've talked a lot about what's going on on the state level. What's happening on the federal level? There's a number of federal bills that the Wildlife Federation is tracking, is advocating on. Bring us up to speed in that arena.
Thank you, Eddie. There are a number of things that we're following that are federal policy and legislation, but I want to focus on two for the purposes of this discussion. Recovering America's Wildlife Act, House H.R. 2773, is a golden opportunity for the future of North Carolina's diverse and very significant wildlife. The act, upon passage, would generate a total of $1.4 billion annually across the nation. Under the formulation embodied in the legislation, North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission would receive $24 million annually. And they would be able to put that to work, the commission, working with partners like the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, will be able to significantly enhance our wildlife conservation efforts across a wide range of species. And you can imagine how important that would be to the future of wildlife in North Carolina. That is currently, it has, as of today, there are 52 co-sponsors. It's bipartisan legislation. We had in the previous session, we had many, many more co-sponsors, and we're building the numbers of that. Right now, North Carolina, we have Congressman Rouser as a co-sponsor, and previously we've had a number of others, and we're working, the Federation is working to get more signers onto that critical piece of legislation. Another area of federal legislation, which dovetails very closely with the work of the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, that's touched on in our excellent article in our Spring 21 journal, Safe Passage, describes our efforts on behalf of wildlife crossing. And there's a federal infrastructure legislation which can bring significant dollars to the four wildlife crossings in a series of competitive grant programs, specifically allowing for wildlife crossings, which include bridges, culverts for passage of both wildlife and aquatic organisms. The federal transportation bill that the Senate just passed out of the relevant committee in the Senate would provide $350 million over 5 years, and it would enhance all aspects of wildlife-related transportation issues, conservation work, including crossings, inspections of old structures, to see what we could do to enhance their usefulness to wildlife or aquatic organisms. And that's, it's got National Wildlife, we're working closely with the National Wildlife Federation on that. That's on the Senate side. And then on the House side, there's a companion legislation, which is somewhat different in terms of the amounts of money, but it's similar, structured in a very similar fashion. And it would involve $400 million over 4 years. So they're per annually over 4 years. So as we're working to see that these bills come together and pass, and this would really allow a ramping up of our wildlife crossings work. And in North Carolina, as many of you know, there's a lot of work that's been done. The Federation's been very involved working with conservation partners on passage in western, extreme western North Carolina on I-40, and then going into Tennessee to benefit our elk and black bear and deer, and reduce, improve human safety by reducing wildlife vehicular collisions, which have a very significant impacts. And we have crossings on Highway 64 in the eastern part of the state, some crossings on I-40 near Wilmington. And the Federation's very engaged in that, in efforts to promote properly designed and sited crossings. And this federal legislation will really provide a critically important tool. And we want to see North Carolina well positioned so that they can take advantage of these competitive grants in the future. So, Eddie, those are two of the main pieces of federal legislation that we're following at this point. Did you have any questions, Eddie?
No, I think you touched on those perfectly, Manly. You know, we've got so many efforts going on the state level, on the federal level. I know folks may have some questions, so I'm going to try to wrap us up here. But, Tim, on these policies that Tom and that Karin and that Manly have brought up, what can listeners do in terms of support? Give folks your top three recommendations for what they can do when they hang up the phone to help out on this.
Absolutely, Eddie, and you're right. From the Clean Water Act to working on our southern bottomland forest to resiliency, I mean, we just barely scratched the surface here, but our team is well at work, and it takes our scientists, our biologists, everybody to make the recommendations that our lobbyists bring forth. Number one, if you want to be engaged in this, send me an email, tim@ncwf.org. We'll match you up with your elected official and kind of give you a lay of the land if they're pro, con, if they need a little push. Sign up for our action alerts. Again, my same email or at ncwf.org. So it's very valuable for a legislator to hear from their actual constituents. And we just greatly appreciate the financial investment by our Shaw Society donors that allow us to do this important work day by day, hour by hour. Sometimes Kari and Manly and our other lobbyists are there till midnight, but you got to have people there making sure no weird amendments show up on bills. So all in all the time, Eddie, and we appreciate everybody's involvement. So with that, I appreciate everybody participating, and let's see what folks have to say or what's on their mind. Any questions? Moderator, we'd love to take questions.
If you have a question for the NCWF panel, please dial *1 on your keypad. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please dial *1 now. And once again, that is *1 if you would like to ask a question to the NCWF panel. We'll pause for just another moment. It appears we have no questions on the line at this time.
Well, I'll
hey, you know what? That just
go ahead, Eddie.
I'm just going to say that. It just tells us that we all knocked it out of the park. Appreciate everybody being here listening. We thanks for all these questions. Again, if you have recommendations to share with Tim or with any of the panelists, the email to contact them is info@ncwf.org. So we're going to wrap this up. Stay well out there. I hope you can get outdoors. I hope you find some time indoors to act on some of these issues that you've that you've heard about. We want to thank everybody here on the Charlie Shaw Call for your time, for your partnership, and for your support for wildlife and habitat in North Carolina. We hope that you enjoy the rest of your day. Goodbye from here.